All right, I'll share one real quick to get us started. There was a cycling race that happened a couple of weeks ago. And actually, I'm just trolling you guys. I'm not even going to talk about cycling this morning, just because I was thinking about how funny it would be to start off with a cycling reference just to hear the internal eye rolls, just to say, okay, moving on. So I'm not even going to talk about it. I just have a picture of a great finish. I was thinking, though, about maybe a very different sports metaphor, but you guys know I'm a Dallas Cowboys fan. You're an Oakland Raiders fan. Come on, go back to this. Every single season, frustrating, sad, unresolved, right? How many years have it been? Well, you guys won a Super Bowl in the 2000s?
No, we went to a Super Bowl.
You went to a Super Bowl.
We should have went to another one. That was
yeah. Oh, yeah. Anyway, so do you guys want to talk about cycling this morning? No, okay, moving on. I was thinking about the Cowboys. Was there any rom-com? I think I had a rom-com note. Was there any, like, rom-coms that came up?
La La Land.
La La Land? I don't know if I remember that one. Castaway?
He made me watch that.
Jennifer Aniston and Vince Vaughn dated really breaking up. You're hoping to get back together.
So we got some like serious angst going on over here. Anything going on?
Yeah.
The Raiders, the Cowboys. What's what? Astros and Dodgers. I was thinking even about companies. Man, how great was it on that Friday afternoon? You'd go over to Blockbuster and you'd get that new release. It's all wound up. You were ready to go. You'd pop it in. You pop that popcorn, and then Blockbusters are just gone. What a loss of that! Talk about going back a frustrating, sad, and unresolved ending. Whoa! You're getting into some. Who was it? Was it the? Man. So other things that I was just finding on the internet was Game of Thrones. I didn't watch it, but people, I guess, were mad at that ending. You were? Lost? The TV show Lost? Any Lost people? Lance Armstrong, close. Thank you for the cycling reference, Brian. You scored big points with that, but you got the wrong guy. But still, just the fact that you're in the, going back to Ronnie, just the fact that you're in the batter's box taking a swing.
How many did he have? Seven.
Yep.
From all the way, right?
Yep. All gone.
I'm impressed you named a different cyclist. Like a cyclist other than Lance Armstrong. That's huge.
All right.
That's huge.
Okay. Speaking of, okay, a little bit of a spoiler alert, 80s, by the way, but you're close. speaking of spoiler alert, the Gospel of Mark. Have we read this yet? Has anybody read this? It's frustrating. It's sad. It's weird. You're going to read it, and you're like, huh? Anybody read this one yet? No? Let's read it. Page 713. I'm going to grab a little more coffee. We'll read it in the round. What's that? I know, you know. I rolled up my sleeves. I got my dress shoes on. All right, who wants to get us started on the big, strange ending in the Gospel of Mark?
When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James, and Salome?
Correct.
Bought spices so that they might go to anoint Jesus' body. Very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb, and they asked each other, who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb?
When they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed.
Don't be alarmed, he said. You were looking for Jesus the Nazarene, who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him, but go tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you.
Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid.
That's it. That's the end of the gospel. Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb, and they said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. Strange ending? Unresolved ending? Weird ending? Now, let's take a quick note here, because you probably are seeing, or maybe in your app or in the Bible or whatnot, you probably see that note that says the earliest manuscripts and some other ancient witnesses do not have, there's this additional ending, 19 or 9 through 20, right? So let's press pause on that ending. We're going to come to that when we kind of get there in the book of Mark. We'll close with that when we talk about the book of Mark. Most people would agree that this is not part of the book of Mark, right? So most people agree that the Gospel of Mark ends in verse 8. Somebody else kind of came along at some point and said, hey, let's put this on the end to kind of tie everything together. Because again, you have this odd, strange, unresolved ending in the Gospel of Mark. So I call it the elephant in the text, right? Why end like this, right? Why would you end? Like, again, we come to Easter morning and we're triumphant and we have our nice clothes on and, you know, churches are going wild this morning with Easter egg hunts and they're, like, everybody's just fireworks. It's just, like, the big event, right? But the Gospel of Mark, at least, ends with a little bit of a, what's the sad note on a guitar? E minor? Like a minor chord. It just kind of ends with this odd strum that you're just like, oh, that's a weird way to end a song. How do we do? There's not many churches where you go on a Sunday morning where the whole service stops because your son has to go potty, but we are one of those. So, again, the elephant in the text, why end like this, right? Why does it end in this kind of thing about a song? Is there any, Brian, maybe you know a song. I didn't think about a song that has a bad ending, right? But why this bad, unresolved, strange ending? Now, there's three options we're going to talk about. One is this. One is what's called a missing text theory, okay? So some would adhere to this idea that maybe, again, there's these early manuscripts that go back to the 4th century, and perhaps at some point when they were written down, translated, relayed, part of that text was lost or damaged or displaced, and we're just missing the ending. Now, N.T. Wright is by far and away, at least at this time in our day and age, the leading New Testament theologian in the world. One of my heroes. You guys, I've told you the story about when I encountered him and my strange encounter with N.T. Wright. If you never heard that story, I'll tell it to you later. But he says, and again, I'm sure you've read it already, he says he's convinced that Mark's ending is missing, right? And he says that we have these early manuscripts, they're from the 4th century, and they end where this text breaks off. And so, like, this is the end. Verse 8, trembling and bewildered, right? The women went out from and fled from the tomb, and they didn't say anything to anyone because they're afraid. That's the end, right? So, I'd love to ask, you know, N.T. Wright or a different New Testament scholar, if I had a chance, and you guys know I'm a preacher and I love preaching, I'm not a scholar, if I could sit down with a scholar and be like, hey, walk me through this thought. Like, what would you say? What are we doing here? Why would you say that this missing text? Is there things that you would see? But again, at least a leading New Testament scholar of our day says that he's convinced of it. So there's that thought. Maybe it just was a missing piece, right? Something got destroyed, damaged, displaced. The second thought is this, which is, let me say this, because another thing that happens in here is if you read Matthew's ending, right? Matthew's ending is very, very similar to the Gospel of Mark. And the angel says to the woman, don't be afraid. I know you're looking for Jesus who was crucified. He's not here. He's risen, just as he said. Come see the place where he lay. Then go tell the disciples he's risen from the dead and is going ahead of you into Galilee. Isn't this all like Mark, right? Then you'll see him. Now I've told you. And then it says, verse 8, the women hurried away. This is Matthew, verse 8, right? The women hurried away from the tomb. And it's a little different here, afraid yet filled with joy. And then they're running to tell the disciples, right? They're not just running away or fleeing. They're running to tell the disciples. And then in verse 9, as Matthew continues on, suddenly Jesus meets them, right? So the women are running to tell the disciples. And then Jesus meets them. Greetings, he said. They came to him and clasped his feet and worshiped him. Then Jesus said to them, do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go into Galilee. There they will see me, right? So again, you kind of have this idea on this missing text where Mark ends there after verse 8, and it's also Mark 16:8. This is Matthew 28:8. Mark ends after verse 8, but in Matthew it carries on. There's some other text. So some people say that the text is missing. Another idea here is what I'll call the disciples' weakness or human weakness. One of the things that we've discovered as we've gone through the Gospel of Mark is Mark isn't particularly favorable or doesn't show the disciples in a very favorable light, right? We've seen this again and again. I think for me, as I've studied the book of Mark and as we've learned through the book of Mark, this has been such a kind of eye-opening revelation, you know, because, again, and I'll go back to this quote. I know I've used this before. This was from back in chapter 6 as we were going through chapter 6. But again, I love the way that Gamba said that, you know, Mark is developing a dynamic throughout his gospel, right? As he's showing the disciples' weaknesses, that he's confronting us, right? He's almost shedding the spotlight on us of whether we are faithfully paying close attention to Jesus so that we understand his identity and the nature of his kingdom, right? So there's this thought here, and I kind of played with the word disciples, right, with a little bit of us at the end, right? Because, again, as Mark is developing this dynamic, he is in some ways shining the spotlight on us. He says it like this in his commentary on chapter 16. He says the human, right, kind of fill in us, disciple us, right? Our tendency, the human tendency, listen to this. This is like, man, this is, we're going to come back to this in a little bit, but our tendency is to be presumptuous, to give ourselves the benefit of the doubt, and overconfidence is a constant danger. We commend ourselves and presume that we are surely the one, we are the ones who are uniquely attentive to Jesus. We assume that we are an objective audience as we read or listen to Mark's gospel, standing safely at a distance and judging the disciples for their flaws. But then this line here, Mark, however, has his crosshairs trained on us, right? We are the target of his portrayal of the disciples. We are the ones who have not listened to Jesus as we should. I put this line at the end. Like, the gospel ends with the women, right? Jesus's followers, they were included, maybe not in the original 12 disciples, but they were definitely part of his followers, right? We are the ones, right? What does it say? The women remained silent. They run away and because they're afraid. But the crosshairs are pointed at us, right? So one of the ending scenarios, right, is much as the Gospel of Mark kind of all along has been, again, developing this dynamic, right, has been teaching us that we are being confronted as the ones who are dull, afraid, cowardly. We are the recipients of the good news of the universe. And we're just scrambling backwards, right? And it is a sober confrontation. Really, it is a sober confrontation with our overconfident spirituality, our prideful Christianity, right? So again, as you kind of read through the Gospel of Mark and you come to this ending where the women run away, they're afraid, they're scared, and you almost, again, are left with this spotlight that's shining on you saying, and what does it look like for you, right? As he's developing this whole thought throughout the Gospels. Now, one other one. This is the last one. There's this last one where we'll call it this kind of intended genius or a little bit forcing discussion. I like this one probably the best. I think there's a lot in here that we can discuss. One of the things we could say about this ending is we have a lot of perspective on this, right? We know that, at least in the Gospel of Mark, the women did not stay quiet, right? They did not just stay afraid. And the women, which again, by the way, against all cultural norms and expectations that women should be the first ones to receive the good news, right? Again, this is a whole nother kind of sermon, but if you were to craft like the perfect people to be able to be the heralds, of the gospel in the ancient Near East, women would not be part of your chosen group. One of the testimonies for the gospel is that the gospel, like, yeah, it was actually the women who did it, right? And it's this kind of counterintuitive way of saying we are being as honest and as reliable and as transparent as possible. It was the women, right? So the women, against all cultural norms and expectations, were the first witnesses, the testimonies to Jesus' resurrection. If they wouldn't have said anything, if they would have just been afraid, running away, quiet, we would have, think about this, we'd have no idea about Jesus' resurrection. Think about that. William Barclay had this, I thought, this is probably the thought of the week for me. William Barclay, in his commentary, he says, one thing is certain. If Jesus had not risen from the dead, we would never have heard of him. The attitude of the women was that they had come to pay the last tribute to a dead body. The attitude of the disciples was that everything had finished in tragedy. By far the best proof of the resurrection is the existence of the Christian church. Barclay says, nothing else could have changed sad and despairing men and women. This is his last line. Into people radiant with joy and flaming with courage, right? It was a wild thought for me this week because I don't know if I've ever, as I thought about the resurrection of Jesus, I don't know if I've ever thought about, again, if he hadn't done this, if he hadn't risen from the dead, and then that kind of accompanying thought, which is, if the women hadn't been bold to go out and speak and to testify and be witnesses, we never would have heard about him. Right? Think about that. It's like, wow. And to think about a world without the hope of a resurrected Christ, the ripples that kind of echo throughout the universe. That took me a long time. I'm still processing this idea just from Barclay of like, wow, this is, right? Nothing else could have changed sad and despairing men and women into people radiant with joy and flaming with courage. So David Garland says it like this, kind of about this ending, right? He says it like this. He says, there's this literary genius, right? This intended literary genius in the sudden ending to the gospel. He says, and listen, we should appreciate its artistic effect. The abrupt ending both surprises and creates suspense. I like to call it almost a fill-in-the-blank ending. This is kind of the way that I look at this ending, right? It surprises and creates suspense. He said, Mark may have felt no need to relate resurrection appearances to readers who had heard them so often. Some things might be more significant when not expressed. And those impressions will make an expression more forcible. Right? Get me picking up what he's laying down here? So here's two examples on this, right? He says there's this literary genius, the way that he stops, right? So, remember the Gospel of Mark is written about the year 50, 60, by the time it's kind of written down and all put together. So you're probably talking 20, maybe 30 years between that, Jesus' resurrection, and the time it's actually written down, right? And he thinks that maybe by then, like, people just, they knew these stories, right? So two examples would be this. If I were to say to you this morning, on a normal September day in 2001, four planes took off, and the sun was rising on the Manhattan skyline. Right? See, I don't need to tell the rest of the story. You're probably getting the memories, the emotions. You can remember where you were. You know what I'm talking about. You know what happened that day. You know the number of lives lost. You know the buildings that collapsed. You know where the other planes crashed. Right? I'm going to say like one line. Right? And all of those, you're able again to fill in the blank everywhere else for yourself. Right? I'm going to take my dad to task a little bit. So my dad is the king of sermon illustrations, right? My dad is a king of sermon illustrations. He has a sermon illustration for every verse in the Bible. I swear it. I'm not, just trust me on that. It's cute. It's cliched. It's whimsical, right? And he always has these little sermon. My dad's going to be out here in June, and I'm going to have him do a whole sermon on the top 10 sermon illustrations he's ever... But he has this. And then what he always does at the end of the sermon illustration is he says this. He says, and the point of the illustration is this, right? So he tells this cute little, like, the point of the illustration is this. And what he does then is he kind of says, This is the interpretation. This is what it's supposed to mean, right? And when I hear my dad do this, I find this, sorry, Dad, if you're listening or watching, he's probably watching right now. I find it kind of frustrating and honestly a little bit counterproductive, right? Because when I hear a story, when my dad tells me these stories, okay, Dad, thank you. This is great. And here's the point of the sermon, and here's these illustrations. Let me use my reasoning, right? So to speak, my mental horsepower, my deductive skill to draw the conclusions. Don't force feed them to me. This, incidentally, is why I love doing discussion at the end of sermons, because I'm saying, hey, here's what the text means, right? But I'm saying, but what do you guys think, right? And then somebody's saying, well, I thought it meant this, and then this kind of stood out to me, and then this comes together. But my dad is always the one saying, and the point of the illustration is this, and he locks these two things together, right? Mark, in some senses, I call it the anti-Pastor Ted sermon illustration ending, if you want to, you know, kind of write that note in your Bible, right? The women run away, they don't tell anyone, and they're afraid, and he almost leaves, again, a little bit of a fill in the blank. What does that mean, to have people run away, afraid, and not telling anyone, right? Mark doesn't say, and the point of the ending is this, right? He doesn't close with that. He just says, that's it. That's the fill in the blank. So there is this little bit of fill in the blank, but then it's interesting that he ends with this word afraid. And the one thing I want to say about this is whenever Jesus would do something, all throughout the Gospel of Mark, right? Whenever Jesus does something to demonstrate his deity, his relationship as the Son of God, this response is always fear. Remember when Jesus calms a storm, right? Stands up, calms a storm. And then what does it say? The disciples, they were afraid at the storm, but they're terrified of Jesus, right? They cross over to the lake in chapter 5. They meet that man who's possessed by the legion of demons. Jesus takes that legion of demons. He casts it out of the man into the pigs. The pigs are in the water, into the lake. And then the townspeople hear about it, and they come out, and they see this man who was demon-possessed, like wild demon possession, right? And the Bible says that he's sitting there dressed and in his right mind. And it says, and they were afraid. Jesus shows he has power over nature itself. Jesus is showing he has power over the demonic forces, right? The woman with the issue of blood who touches his garment, right? We talked about that. It was that symbol that Jesus was the Messiah, the anointed one, right? And Jesus says, whoa, power's gone out for me. Who touched me? And he's looking around. The women, trembling, needed a break anyway, thanks James, right? Trembling, she falls at his feet and tells him the whole truth. He goes to heal the synagogue ruler's dead daughter, Jesus showing his power over death. And as he's doing this, the people come from his house and say, oh, your daughter's dead, don't bother the teacher anymore. And Jesus says, don't be afraid, just believe. Jesus walks on water. Jesus is transfigured. Jesus predicts his death and resurrection. Anytime Jesus does something that really demonstrates his deity in the Gospel of Mark, the response is fear. Now, one of the interpretations on fear, because again, when we think about fear, we just think about somebody who's scared, who's frightened. But I love this idea of fear or being afraid. Think about this. Shock, awe, disturbance. Think about fear in which categories or presuppositions are deconstructed or destroyed. That understanding is stretched, right? Again, don't just think of like, okay, well, he was just scared, right? Like, remember when we saw the mouse? By the way, I'm catching those mouse for you guys, just so you know, okay? I'm getting them. We saw the mouse and you're like, you're not just that scared, but think about fear in the sense that your presuppositions, what you think to be about the world, are deconstructed, destroyed. Your understanding is stretched. So in this example, when the Bible ends in this idea of fear, right? The women run up there. They were, trembling and bewildered. They said nothing. The women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. The women, having gone to Jesus' tomb, they encounter an angelic being who says that Jesus is not here. He's risen, right? A demonstration of his deity, right? in which they have to categorically stretch. Okay, well, now what does that mean? Think about that. What does that do to my presuppositions, to what I think about this world, right? To my assumptions, to my beliefs. So they end with this. And again, when you do that, it does two things. It makes you go back, right? It will make us, again, as this audience, we go back and we re-examine, we reread all of Jesus' life, right? This whole theme in Mark's gospel, to open our eyes, to see Jesus for who he is. We reconsider his passion predictions. In 14, he says, hey, just by the way, after I've risen, I'm going to go ahead of you into Galilee, right? And again, they were probably thinking like, after he did what? And you're going to go where? Right? But then he does it, right? And you go back and you reread when he said that, and he's actually, yeah, I'm alive, and I'm going to go into Galilee. I'll meet you there, right? But then again, it now makes us take the step forward, the leap of faith forward into a world that has Jesus as the resurrected Messiah, right? So what does that mean for us? The three endings of Mark, right? That there's some sort of missing text. It shows perhaps our weakness. It's this intended genius. It forces this discussion. It's a fill in the blank. What does it mean for us? I just kind of want to make it maybe a little bit personal, because I think if you think about the first one, right, that there is just missing text. Something's missing. Something's not there. Something has, right? And I was thinking about this maybe for you this morning. Maybe you're sitting here this morning and I feel often incomplete, lacking, unresolved. Like, sometimes it feels like our life, like, God, just something's missing in my life. You know what I mean? Like, we feel that, like, that lack, that incompleteness, that something's not there. And I would say to you that whatever that is for you, if you have that sense, when you feel that sense, to remind you that God's not done writing your story. God's speaking to you this morning. He says, I know that there's some parts missing. I've known that you're trying to make sense of your life. I know you have this sense of incompleteness. And he wants again to speak to you. He says, I'm not done with you yet. Right? What I started in chapter 1, I will be faithful to complete. I'm not done writing your story, right? So the second one, though, too, kind of to go into that second ending, is this. I call it just like, man, like a sober self-examination, right? Again, this idea that all throughout the Gospel of Mark, the crosshairs are pointed on us, right? And I took Gombas's quote, and then I just put you. And by when I say you, right, I'm also saying, I'm speaking to us all individually, myself too, right? So this isn't the pastor saying, you guys better get your act together because I have my act together. The point is for all of us, right? Let's read this. Your tendency to be presumptuous, to give yourself the benefit of the doubt and overconfidence is a constant danger. Think about that in your life. You commend yourself and presume that you are the one who is uniquely attentive to Jesus. You assume that you are an objective audience as you read or listen to Mark's gospel, standing safely at a distance and judging the disciples for their flaws, or just judging others for their flaws, right? The whole gospel of Mark has had his crosshairs trained on you. You are the target of his portrayal of the disciples. You are the one who has not listened to Jesus as you should. You are the one who is silent, afraid, running away. And this, again, this, at some level, I know I had to listen to this a little bit myself this week. At some level, this should sober you up. I had an idea of actually buying smelling salts and making you all take a giant whiff of smelling salts, of the good old ammonia smelling salts this morning. When was the last time you hit one of those?
Our son goes to smell this.
And he got you? He tricked you? Oh my gosh. How was that? Speaking from first experience, this is what it, huh?
Painful.
It's painful, right?
Painfully sobering.
Right? Man, thank you for sharing that. Did you see go home and tell your son he was a prophet. Because you hit a smelling salt and it just will painfully shock you. And again, the Gospel of Mark should be doing this in our lives at some level, right? We float through life with armchair Christianity, and often our greatest challenge is traffic and what's for dinner. And this is a sobering self-examination. And then the last thing, last is, you know, get this fill in the blank ending. Here's the words that I want to end with this morning, is this slide. And this is, you know, again, just this whole thing. Challenge, like, are we ready to take the leap of faith forward with Jesus into a world that has him as the resurrected Son of God? And to allow ourselves to be drastically transformed from despair and apathy and anger and cynicism and sin, again, stealing from Barclay, into people radiant with joy, flaming with courage, filled with the Spirit-infused love and forgiveness that can change a universe. Now, I like this little phrase here I heard earlier this week. It could be annoyingly naive. Isn't that a great little phrase? Think about somebody who's so naive they're annoying, right? The resurrection could be annoyingly naive. Oh, those Christians, they're so silly, they're so naive, they're just a little bit annoying. It could be annoyingly naive, right? To believe and to hope and to trust in such an event. But honestly, is there anything better? Isn't that why we're here this morning? Because there's nothing more worthy. There's nothing more compelling. There's nothing more beautiful than Jesus, who is the greatest man to live, to walk out of the tomb on that Sunday morning, defeating death and disease and darkness, the power of sin and hell for now and forevermore. Right? And we are the ones that are holding the line, right? That there is still hope and love and beauty in this world. So let's close with those thoughts. We're going to pray. Lord, for my brothers and sisters who are here this morning, I just pray that maybe you spoke to them at one of those different levels. For those who are feeling a little bit, they feel that despair of incompleteness, of lack. Something's missing, and you want to remind them that you're not done writing their story. Maybe we need to be hit with some smelling salts this morning, right? Maybe we need to be reminded that you're kind of pointing to us and saying, hey, I want you to remember who I am, right? And then, you know, maybe for those this morning, kind of with this fill in the blank, man, to be hopeful, to hold the line, even to be annoyingly naive of who you were, of what you did, and what you said you were going to do, and what that means for the universe forever, in all places, to trust in that. We open our hearts and our minds, our souls, to that reality. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.